Hello, my friends. I'm Shay Marville. Welcome to the second season of Let's Talk, a podcast dedicated to healing and growing through conversations, stories, and deep listening. We are an alchemy of one another. Talking helps us to relieve our burdens, to suffer less, because we are each other's medicine if we choose. So let's talk. Hello, my friends. Welcome to Let's Talk. On today's episode, I have a very, very special guest. And for the record, she and I are third cousins on my mother's side. But the reason I'm interviewing her is because she is extraordinary. She's an extraordinary storyteller. She's an award-winning writer, producer, director, and a passionate artistic activist committed to boldly telling stories of resistance and change. Allison, welcome to Let's Talk. What are you working on right now?
What am I doing right now? Well, there's a lot going on at OEM Media Group. First of all, we are in production on a film called, well, there's several titles for this film. I don't even want to say the title, but it's a film and it's a documentary that Lori Townsend is directing. And she was just in Germany for a week filming, and she's following the story of Stacey Ann Chin, who is a, you know, stalwart, amazing poet,
yes,
LGBT activist, author, a remarkable story, you know, of her being left behind in Jamaica, and her mom immigrated to Canada at first, so she could have been Canadian. But it's, I don't want to get into the story because you have to invite Lori back to talk about that, but that's one of the things that we're working on. And then in addition to that, I'm directing another feature documentary called Bam Bam, The Story of Sister Nancy. And it's about the wild ride behind the making of the song Bam Bam and her life. You know, this woman has toured for 40 years, you know, with that one song that was on her only album, which was called the 1-2 album. Just making an incredible living, there's a lot of twists and turns in her life and in that song, about that song. And as we know, it's like the most sampled reggae vocal in the world. All the hip-hop artists, from Kanye to, you know, Jay-Z to Lauryn Hill to Alicia Keys, like they've all sampled this song.
And people are rediscovering her right now, right? Like rediscovering it now.
Absolutely. I heard it was in the Maid series that's just out. I think it's one of the songs that they sing or it's played. I haven't binged the Maid yet. I haven't had time, but that's on my list. And it's also featured in the newest James Bond movie.
Allison, how did you find yourself in the world of directing and writing? Because your way in has not been a straight line.
Yes, my way into directing and writing has not been a straight line. It's been a one of discovery of my own voice. It's a journey of my curiosity. I have a lot of, you know, I have this really strong curiosity about how the world works, how things work, how did people get in this situation, that kind of thing. Just a tremendous curiosity about things. And as we know, as good as our education here is here in Canada, it's fairly limited when you look at, you know, the diasporic story, the diversity within Blackness. I really followed that. And as you know, our families, you know, we're related, you know, our family's from Guyana. And just like in Guyana, there's like six different types of people that live in this one country. So it's just like, it's just a constant learning and discovery of who we are and 100%, you know, how we are all connected and what's the same about all of us and what's different about people.
You see, this is one of the reasons I find your work in the arts, creative, documentary ecosystem exciting, because I'm obviously, you know, we're third cousins. I actually discovered you later in life in my late teens and was excited, you know,
our mothers actually were very close and grew up together in Guyana. And, but it wasn't until, you know, I was in my teens, you know, you were in your teens that we actually got to know each other. Your perspective though, as a person from the diaspora, from a diverse country, in a country where our story is invisible, is so interesting to me. And I think we're just at this sort of infancy in terms of starting to tell the nuances of Black experience or multicultural Black experience.
Yes, and that's a great point because I just remember, you know, my dad telling me a lot of stories about Guyana, you know, it was all, you know, kind of passed down by this oral history about who was there and who, what they did. I knew that, you know, my grandfather, Heinard Miller, he was Amerindian. And yes, just knowing that, you know, his people, where they came from and where they live. And then knowing my dad would talk about Burnham, you know, because yeah, he went to school with Burnham and a Black man who ran
the one-time president of Guyana
and his life. And then he would tell me about, you know, if there was someone from, you know, a South Asian community that came over as an indentured servant, like what their life was like. And, you know, just all the mixtures in our family. I grew up with that. And then when I came to Canada, I noticed that there was none of that. Yes. Not even, you know, very limited information about the Indigenous community, which we are finding out is really, you know, harmful and has been oppressive for a long time, but only like a sort of like a myopic view of who is in Canada and how the country was created. Mm-hmm. And so that was always a tension for me as a Canadian, because I was born here, you know? And so it's like, what is going on? Like, why is my, you know, why are my family members, like my dad and my mom was a huge family. She had lots of stories. Why am I getting all of that from where they came from and then not here?
Do you think that heritage gives you a new lens into trying to tell stories about what Canada is and how we perceive one another? Like, so we're not looking at people from this position of you represent Native culture, you represent Black culture. It's this kind of mix up pepper pot, you know, of a fusion of people that you're able to see naturally without it being forced.
Yeah, it's just so natural for me because that's the way I see the world. And that's the way the world is kind of in Toronto. Yes. When you walk down the street, it is like that. Yes. So that's what I want to see on screen.
Did you always know you wanted to direct?
I just knew I wanted to tell stories. I was a very observant kid. I didn't talk much when I was younger. I struggled with speech. But I was thinking a lot about the world and how it was created. And, you know, I felt like I was a lot of the time in this sort of like dreamlike state when I was by myself, just thinking about things and how things were connected. My brain was always very active. And I fell in love with the sciences, went to school, did really well in the sciences, thought I was going to be a kinesiologist. I had a master's degree in kinesiology. I still have it.
Well, you have a master's degree.
I have a master's degree in kinesiology and worked, you know, in the sports sciences for many years and really fell in love with how the body works and how, you know, your mind functions and thinking about how, you know, athletes succeed. I've studied a range of things under that umbrella kinesiology.
And you were a basketball player. You played basketball for a long time. So was that part of how you got into studying the body?
Yes, I love the sports of basketball. I played many sports when I was growing up, you know, volleyball, soccer, a little bit of track, but I fell in love with basketball. I loved the fact that it was a team sport. that was there was a real strategy with playing basketball. As you can see, now when you watch the professionals play, there's a strategy behind it. It's a thinking game. It's a physical game. It's a thinking game. And I really love both aspects of it. There was something that happened to me when I became more of an elite player. You know, playing basketball allowed me to travel the world and, you know, and do many things and go to school. I realized when I was on top of my game, there was a synergy that happened where everything was slowed down for me on the court. And I can see things before it happened. I became a very, very good player to the fact that, you know, won many awards playing basketball. I was inducted to the Hall of Fame at the University of Windsor for my for my basketball playing there, and broke records, scoring records, defensive records. But there's something that's happened to me physically, mentally, I would even say spiritually, that I knew that you could, all of these things can be connected in the line for me to perform the skill. So I would say, you know, the playing of basketball allowed me to experience that. And that's what I carried on into my filmmaking.
That's so fascinating because, I mean, there's so many things there to sort of unpack. You don't necessarily think of going from athleticism and being elite and an elite athlete to then also being a storyteller, creator. Not that, I mean, they're obviously related, but your trajectory into it is a bit unusual.
Yes. It's sort of like the connecting of the mental, physical, and the spiritual in creating something.
I love this. I love this.
And that's what happens for me. I can look at, you know, a subject matter, and I'm very interested in social justice themed films, although that's a wide umbrella, but there's a lot of things there that I'm interested in. But when I'm able to understand it, so mentally understand it, physically do the work to get what I need, and then have this deeper connection to the work, the spiritual, that's when I feel like I'm creating like work that I want to, but also it kind of mimics what how I was raised in the athletic world, what I discovered in the being an athlete. I always try to connect with my work that way.
Was it hard for you growing up being both really engaged intellectually, very smart, but then also had a really high ability around athleticism and like trying to juggle? Like, did you feel torn, like you had to choose one over the other? Or did you always feel that you could do both?
I always thought I could do both because I thought that the sport that I selected to play for a long time, I think I played basketball for maybe 20, 30 years. I played it at a level where you had to think while you were playing.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it wasn't just a physical game. It was about thinking. It was about strategizing.
Strategy.
Right. And about seeing a way before you are actually there in that position. Like, how do I get from here to there and score when this person who's a really good player is over there, and this other person who I hate when they defend me is over there? How do I get to the basket?
Yes.
With your team. And when your mind has been trained that way at a very high level, it doesn't stop just because you're doing something else. You do carry those skills whatever to whatever you're doing, as long as you're exercising those muscles. And I feel like creating art allows me to exercise those muscles still.
Wow. Do you feel that the art you are creating now is intentional, mission-driven, or is it, you know, about, as you discover stories of people, you just tell those stories, or do you have a mission that you're driving right now?
Yeah, that's a great question. I feel like I always have a mission around social justice, showing that people are equal, fighting for equity, fighting for awareness of certain issues that I think that, you know, with a little bit of elbow grease, we can and if people come together, that we can fight and and change in a positive direction. I also think that I'm having a lot of fun right now. I'm having a lot of fun because I've worked at this so hard. I feel like, you know, I kind of know what I need to know to feel free with what I'm doing. And so it doesn't matter what I'm working on. It just seems like I'm playing a little bit more. I'm having a lot of fun with it.
Is that part of the spirituality of what you're doing, that there's this kind of, you know, organic evolution that's occurring with your work right now? You're kind of doing what's in your spirit?
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like I'm doing what's in my spirit, and I'm also trusting the process a little bit more. As I become more and more confident, I feel that, oh, this feels similar. Oh yeah, I remember I did that. Oh yeah, and that didn't turn out so badly when I did it that way. Or, oh, you know, I remember I did that. And hey, you know, I didn't really like it how it turned out last time. Let me tweak something here.
Yes.
I recognize it. Let me tweak something here and let's go with it. You know, that's one thing. And then also working with some phenomenal people, like people who are just so talented that, you know, I can trust that they're going to deliver what needs to be delivered on the day. So I feel like I'm just present so that I'm able to play with them. So directing is kind of, it's an interesting thing because a lot of it is me playing with the talent and, you know, playing with the cinematographer, really wanted to explore an issue in a fresh way and letting go to the process.
There's two things that come to mind as you share this. Like, one, I'm wondering just chronologically how you evolved into directing. I know you started with video, so I'd love for you to share that a little bit. Then there's another question about the confidence that I want to get to and this idea of being an imposter. And I'm kind of curious about if that's something that you ever feel, if you're ever plagued by that. I've got some issues with the whole concept of imposter syndrome. I think it's a response to a society that says, always asks you to prove your value.
I know
a lot of people, it really resonates. Like, what about you as a director, writer, evolving producer, always, does imposter syndrome come into your orbit?
Yeah, the imposter syndrome used to really plague me a lot because, you know, as you're learning anything, you kind of forget what you've learned. And every situation you go into is like, oh, I don't know what I'm doing, blah, blah, blah. This is so, am I the right person? Is this the right story? Why me? You know, all this stuff. You know, I kind of settled into, like, I actually know a lot of stuff. I've been at this for a long while, and to the point where I'd be in situations and I can see the difference from the last time and this time, my understanding of the situation might have moved beyond, you know, oh, it's not just the lens. It's about, is everybody comfortable now on set?
Yes.
Like, is the actor, you know, are they trusting the scene? Am I giving them enough attention? Am I just looking at the equipment? Like, all these little things. I've just kind of settled into who I am and being okay with, you know, I still won't know everything. It doesn't matter. But what matters is that I'm here and that I am present to tell the story. And whatever I don't know, there's all these, you know, people that are getting paid lots of money who agreed to do this and who are just equally as talented or more so that can have the answer for me.
And your job together as a director is to sort to have the vision, right?
Yeah.
And to be able to continually hold that vision in place as you're building the story.
Yes, like I'm the keeper of the story. There's a lot of other people that are invested in the story, like the cinematographer, the producer, the writer, who's not usually on set, the art department, you know, the production designer. They're all invested in the story. My job is to, you know, keep the ship going, so that we can finish a film and the story is intact. It's not going to always be the same story that you started out with, even on paper. You know, you have to make adjustments on set, but even understanding that and knowing that, and having confidence in to do that on set, you know, tweak things here as you go, make things go deeper, do all the prep that you're supposed to do to get to a point where, you know, you have that freedom to work with an actor if you know, they're having an issue or you're having an issue explaining what you want. Like, you have to, you know, you have to put the work in. But what I'm saying about this is essentially is, you know, putting the prep into it, but then also being confident that you are enough.
That you are enough.
Yes.
And that, and what you bring is enough.
Is enough for that, for being a director.
Oh, wow. When do you think you kind of hit your mojo, your stride, like your flow in that sense?
I feel that I hit my mojo and flow in directing in pre-production, when I'm going through the shot list, when I'm timing out the shots, when I'm sitting with, you know, my cinematographer and we're going through everything and, you know, we agree on the shots. And then we go back to the production designer and we say, hey, we're trying to do this. Or maybe there's an issue, like we want to do this kind of shot, but there's an issue. And then you're working with the actors and seeing if they, you know, want to play the scene the way you see it and making those tweaks. I really, you know, when, as I get further and further of the process in pre-production, that's when I hit my stride. So being on set, it's just sort of easy. It's sort of like, okay, I see this. I'm relaxed enough so I can come up with really good shots in addition to what's on the storyboard, or even go deeper, or even say, hey, let's scrap that way. Let's do it this way. It's better. Or being able to listen to people on set when you run into trouble to see if anybody can come up with a good idea that can get you out of a pickle, because you're always going to get into those, you know, situations where you're like, it looked good on paper. It sounded good on rehearsal. We actually don't have the 3 hours to shoot this, but we only have 15 minutes to get this shot. What are we going to do? You know, when you do all that prep beforehand and you're relaxed and you're open to listening to people around you, the answer comes.
Right.
But I do know that the answer will come. I'm never afraid that, oh my gosh, you know.
You created your own production company.
Yes.
Right. And was that because it was challenging to get work produced and funded in Canada? Like, that's a leading question. But I just... why did you do that versus... I'm just going to work for whatever project comes up or apply for whatever project comes up?
Shay, that's a great question. I started this production company, Oh Yeah Media Group, not by myself, with Gaddy Conte-George, another filmmaker, primarily works in documentary, but also works in immersive content now. You know, I met her about 7 years ago, maybe 8 years ago. And we worked together about 8 years ago on a project called the Kua Benjamin Legacy Project.
Yes.
But before that, she asked me for notes on her film, The Flying Stars, which is a feature documentary about an amputee soccer team in Sierra Leone. And she asked me for notes and we got along then. And then when I was asked to executive produce the Kua Benjamin Legacy series, I brought her on as one of the directors, one of five directors, all Black females in Canada who are just extraordinary. And we got along. And then she came back to me with a film she wanted to do on Winston the Rose, which eventually became Mr. Jane and Finch.
Yes.
And it was during that process that we were, she was kind of doing the same thing I was doing with my company. I had a company called Goldilocks Productions, and I had that for about 20 years. And it was essentially me, you know, with this hybrid model, making films for community, but also broken out my services as a director and producer to other productions. And it was just sort of like a very, you know, small thing, my independent production company. And she had a company called Matru Media, and she was kind of doing the same thing and coming up and had some really, you know, good clients. And we decided, you know, why don't we come together, kind of eliminate a lot of the redundancies that you'd have.
See, I was wondering about that. Yeah. Like, I was wondering how you came to sort of moving Goldilocks onto the side and creating this new entity. So I think it's interesting that you, I love this. I love that you're sharing this piece and the value of the collaboration, right?
Yeah, it was very collaborative. But I think with me at the point of time in my career, I was thinking of shifting from filmmaking to film education. And I went back to do my master's degree in fine arts and production at York University. I just had enough of the film industry trying to get funding, trying to, you know, make other work, bigger productions. I was kind of burnt out. And I was thinking about leaving or just at least having another source of income and teaching possibly. So I did my master's in that time. It was the coming of together that was really lifted my spirits because one, you know, you're not so lonely. You're not just making projects by yourself. You're making it. You have a business partner who is there with you. You can strategize together. You can, you know, kind of feed off of each other. You know, we do different things in our company. You're not doing everything
on your own,
you know, on your own. You can split up the work. And it was through that. It was just like, just ballooned. Mr. Jane and Finch did really well. We did. It's such a great film. You know, we won 2 Canadian Screen Awards and the Donald Britton Award for best social justice documentary and best documentary writing. And which I'm just really proud of both of those things. I'm not sure if we're the first Black women that won that award or those awards, but somebody should look into that. But that was really amazing that, you know, that happened. And yeah, from that, it's just, our company just, you know, grew. So I'm like, oh, no more teaching for me.
No, you teach
in a different way. We have the, Emerging Filmmakers Program, which we do a lot of education through that.
Right. And you're so incredibly busy right now. Has the pandemic made things busier and more opportunistic for you? Or have you been like hunkered down, you know, focused on, you know, just trying to keep everything stabilized?
Yeah, that's a great question about the pandemic. I think we're busier than ever. We're really, really busy. During the pandemic, what we did was we kind of hunkered down during the pandemic and spent a lot of time and energy honing our whatever we had in development, you know. Yeah. So, you know, reaching out to writers, shaping up, you know, different projects, shooting some stuff, and, you know, really worked on, you know, the stories themselves that we wanted to go into production with. And that's paid off. It's almost like everything we put our hand to is getting funded. And so we're trying to find a way of balancing everything. It's just a testament to, you know, the work that we put in to create dynamic, entertaining projects. We're moving more in that direction with bigger budgets as well.
Did the George Floyd trauma and, you know, all of the sort of racial reckoning that came out of the US that sort of went global, did that have a huge impact on what you were working on, what you and your team were working on here in Canada?
Yes, I think George Floyd, and his name should be, you know, hopefully it's held down in history. It's made a lot of people aware of the racism that people are feeling around the world and experienced around the world. And I think what happened in our industry, you know, people looked around in their own companies and, you know, broadcasters, streamers, you know, funders, and looked around and thought, we don't have Black people working here, or we don't have like senior Black people in senior management. We don't have, you know, Black people involved in the huge funding agencies. We don't have Black people here and there. And then at the same time, what had happened with the indigenous community with the Truth and Reconciliation and discovering that, they, you know, they had been oppressed for so long, and they were in a worse position in terms of, you know, how they were being treated in the industry. Yeah. And seeing the industry having to pivot, really, you know, recognize some of the extraordinary talent that comes from that community, and also respect it, the community, and also respect the filmmakers, and provide a way for them to make work at a very high level. You know, that was really important to see. And I know that process is ongoing. I like to talk about what had happened to the indigenous community and what still is happening. You know, we're talking about, you know, the disappearance, the missing and murdered indigenous women. We're talking about, you know, the trauma of finding bodies in residential schools. Like mm-hmm. that must be, you know, hearing about family members that just disappeared. You don't know what happened. And then they're discovering all these mass graves and these sites. And that's important for us to, I know I'm going on a little bit of a tangent, but that is important for us to hold up high, because in addition to George Floyd, because we are on their land, you know, those two things, you know, kind of work together in this whole racial reckoning time to really give people who have been traditionally oppressed a voice.
Yes.
In this industry. And I think that's helpful. I think that's helpful for creators like us who are talking about social justice and history and, you know, trying to, you know, tell stories that, you know, uplift us and empower us.
What do you think your role is as a filmmaker in managing and processing the trauma of what we are hearing, seeing, coming to terms with? Where does your work intersect there, do you feel that you're part of this processing of all of this pain?
I think there's so many stories out there about negative things that happen to the Black community, but it's not nearly enough. I feel like a lot of people talk about, you know, not re-traumatizing and all of that. And I think I understand the point, but I do think that that's a little bit naive in terms of how things actually work, because if you don't show the issue or the problem, then people forget, they think mm-hmm. it's over. And then you have a George Floyd, you know, situation. Yeah. I'm all for, you know, creating work about Black joy. As a matter of fact, our young people are actually working on a project. Our year four participants in their Emerging Filmmakers program, they're working on a project about Black joy. But I do think it's my responsibility to hold the historical record up high and let people know what's going on. Because at the end of the day, until there's equity across the board and, you know, people are not being oppressed by, you know, living with HIV or living in an uncertain neighborhood or where they can't come from or language or whatever, LGBT, who they love, you know, what gender they are, you know, until that happens, then, you know, I'm going to keep telling stories that, you know, that test people and push people to think about these issues.
Do you also think that it's also about, for the people who are experiencing the trauma, the racism, the exclusion, it's important for them to hear or see that they're not alone, or that this is not an imaginary experience. This is real. It's happening to them.
I think that's really important. As a matter of fact, I made a short film when I went back to school, it's called Promise Me. And it's still touring the festival circuit. It's been out for 2 years now. And it's about a woman living with HIV.
Yes.
And it's about her daughter being a caregiver. And, you know, also about her being under surveillance by child welfare and the educational system. And I just, you know, saw someone, met with someone who's from that community who's, you know, also went back to school, and they're, you know, they're doing their doctorate, and she has HIV, and she goes, thank you for this film. This situation happens so often to so many of us. You know, our families, once we say that we're HIV positive, our families become under surveillance by different institutions. And I tell people this all the time. And she's told me about 3 or 4 cases. I, in fact, while I was making the film, knew of many cases. So I try to put them all in to one story while highlighting or memorializing somebody I knew that went through this and passed away. And she just thanked me. And I said, you know, I know people might think that I'm, you know, just trying to re-traumatize people, or, you know, or this is too traumatic. And I kind of, and I worried about that. And she goes, no, this is very helpful for our community. I had some solace in that, because I felt like, okay, so I can't second guess what other people are going to think, because it's not like all, not, it's not a story that's, you know, wrapped up in a happy bow and kumbaya and all that stuff.
Yes.
You know, it's talking about real stuff that happens to our community here in Canada. Mm-hmm. And I remember also when making the film, you know, somebody had told me that, oh, social workers don't act like that. And I said, well, how do you know? And they were like, my friend is a social worker. And I'm like, well, I do know that they act like that, because I actually adopted a little girl. And I know social workers, when they came into my home, they kind of acted like that. So, you know, I've actually experienced that, right? And, you know, and so it's kind of this thing that I think sometimes we're living in a bubble. We want things to be all rosy all the time.
But it's like about putting up a mirror, isn't it? Yeah. Because I think, like, sometimes in the social work practice, there's a kind of training. You know, I mean, it's changing now, but there's a kind of training that you're serving the underprivileged, you know, I'm saying, air quotes, and that somehow their values are different. And so you perceive people, you know, based on, you know, what they look like, without even thinking, I am perceiving people in a certain way because of what they look like. And then I'm attributing value to them because of what they look like. And then I'm treating them a certain way. And I think sometimes it's not until people see themselves on the screen, and it's not, and they can say, oh my God, you know, not everyone, but sometimes you go, wow, like, have I asked someone that question in that way? Have I judged a person, you know, that I'm supposedly helping?
Exactly. That question, like that, one of the questions that came up in the film was, you know, why did you make that appointment? You know, you said you were going to be there. And the answer, well, I was sick. Like, this medication is actually putting me, you know, putting me under, and I'm immobilized. And it's like, well, we're going to take your kid away if you don't, you know, do what you say, kind of thing. And that happens. You know, these ideas of rules. And also looking at Black women, like, you're stronger than, you know, you say you are, you know, you're not going by, you know, medically, you're ill, you're in pain, you're suffering, and not believing Black women. That's been documented in the medical profession.
Yes.
There's studies, you know, showing the bias of medical professionals.
Yeah, not believing.
Not believing, you know.
The pain that Black women are in, or Black women themselves not being able to say they're in pain.
Not able to say they're in pain. And we know that there's a, you know, historical underpinning with that. You know, if you go back to, you know, being indentured or being enslaved, there's a history of that.
Listen, I could spend all day. Like, I could honestly just sit and listen to you. Like, I think you have to teach. And I know time is going, but I have a question about this idea of, like, the Black woman trope of strength. Because I think this is interesting, like, what you're talking about in terms of how Black women are perceived in healthcare. But I wonder about also just the whole idea of that pressure, that as a Black woman, in quotes, again, I'm doing air quotes, you don't either feel things the way other people do, that you have to be strong all the time, somehow it's not acceptable. And I'm not actually talking about people who aren't black. I'm talking about black people perceiving themselves this way, black women perceiving themselves this way. They're not allowed to cry or to be soft or to be vulnerable.
Yeah, somehow along the line, we've been indoctrinated, trained, whatever, that we can't be vulnerable. And I think, you know, we have all adopted a little bit of that just for our own survival. I think about that, what you just said, in terms of, you know, who listens to Black women, you know, and the voice of a Black woman. Is it recognized in the way it should be? Is it celebrated in the way it's should be? Is it respected in like a white man's, for example, you know? And I would have to say 9 times out of 10, no. And I feel like that is why for a long time you didn't see that many Black female directors used to a certain, you know, a certain type of person to listen to, right?
Yes, yes.
So it's very exciting to see, you know, Black women breaking through in this role as directors, as producers, as writers, as actors, you know, as leading actors, leading a whole movie. You know, it's great to see that because that means that, you know, people are willing to listen to her voice.
Yes.
You know, for at least, you know, 2 hours.
Yes. And okay. that voice isn't just the voice of one people, but you can represent a story that reaches many, many people from many, many different backgrounds. Are you interested in breaking into the US, is that something that drives you at all?
I'm laughing. I'm interested in anywhere the stories that I am telling and I will be telling get supported. I will go anywhere. I really love living in Toronto. So I don't know if I would live in the States, but I can definitely work in the US. I have lots of friends who are in America who are filmmakers. And shout out to them. But I'm a Toronto girl, and I think there's a different perspective that I bring and maybe a fresh perspective making work in the States. I think it's just a matter of budgets and working with different distributors and outlets. But I think that's pretty much coming.
Yes. And do you think, I mean, I know that there was a time where you were doing more traveling. I mean, like everyone, but you were doing more traveling to Africa. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course, you know, there's so many, many diverse stories from that continent. Is that something that's going to be more part of your work as you go forward as well?
Yeah. These are great questions because I do have a script about as an immigration / hero's journey from, you know, West Africa to Canada. It's a really amazing story. I started writing it about a year ago. I'm still in the process of writing it. It's based on a true story. I just love the story. So that's one I want to tell. And I think people would just be amazed at this story. I see it could be Idris Elba as the lead, but he might be getting too old. No, I shouldn't say that.
He can never be too old, Idris Elba.
For everyone, I'm only joking. Hopefully they get his attention. But yeah, he would be amazing in it. And then there's a story that I'm working on. It's more like a local social justice story, women-led story that I think that's an international story. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of the films that I'm making now in terms of just developing now, they're international in scope.
Yes.
And that's where I want to be because I want the stories that I'm doing to have international conversations. I surely did that with my documentaries, especially, you know, my earlier work and also the community-based documentaries that I've made have been all over the world, especially when I was talking about HIV or Indigenous issues. You know, they've traveled quite a bit. So I think I can continue that with this next phase, especially with the dramatic work that I'm doing.
I'm so excited. I love observing and watching and listening to everything that you're bringing to the cultural diaspora in terms of, you know, the stories and the points of view. You know, I'd love, you know, of course, I want you back on the show to have other conversations because we're, I think the conversation around, you know, vulnerability and sharing our stories openly, I think we need more space to do that. And I just have to tell you, you know, my mom loved you so much, but I just want to tell you that my mom, she was such a huge fan of you. And she's always thought you were so brave. I know that being brave also requires rest. So I hope you get lots of rest and care, but I just want you to know how much you're admired. Thank you for being here.
Oh, yeah, I love your mom and I miss your mom. And I know that she and my mom got along great. And I saw my mom on the weekend. She just says, hi, by the way. And she's so to moms, right?
Yeah, to moms. To the braveness and the courage, you know, they showed in coming here with nothing and creating a life. So we're so lucky and blessed. My darling, I'll talk to you again very soon. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me on Let's Talk. Congratulations. It's a great show.
Thank you.
All right.
I'm Shay Marville, and you've been listening to Let's Talk, a podcast dedicated to healing and growing. You can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. And listen, I need your help to grow the reach of this show. Could you, would you, please subscribe, rate, and review us on any platform that you're listening to. I'd love to hear your feedback. Ciao for now.